This episode of Zero to Travel is brought to you by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. With 7 drive modes, the Pathfinder's built for even the most epic journeys. Learn more at NissanUSA.com.
I always also say, don't stay near the Eiffel Tower. That is like one of the most searched things. Everybody wants to stay near the Eiffel Tower. There are 2 reasons not to. One is that half of the hotels with Eiffel Tower in their name are nowhere near the Eiffel Tower. So unless you know your geography well enough, people get suckered into this all the time. They stay in some place that's like 2 miles away from the Eiffel Tower, and it just has the name in the hotel. And then they're disappointed to discover, no, it's not near the Eiffel Tower. Secondly, even if you can stay near the Eiffel Tower, unless you really love the 7th, which is the 7th and the 15th, which are the Eiffel Tower is in the 7th, the 15th is bordering it, have a lot to offer. They're actually really wonderful. The 7th is very old money. It's very like big boulevards, beautiful buildings. But the majority of the kind of stuff that I personally would love to do and that I recommend people do is nowhere near there.
That is Jay Swanson, who's today's guest. He shares helpful, uncommon advice for travelers visiting Paris. It's consistently one of the most visited cities in the world. So I thought, well, it's well worth having him on here today. Chances are, if you're listening to this, you've either been to Paris or you're going to go one day. Some of the things he shares, where to actually stay, and how to meet locals, talking about the notable literary history. Where can you go to have a nice coffee and do some writing that is not your typical place? Where to eat all the delicious meals, all the good stuff. But this podcast is about much more than Paris. You know, that's how we roll here. Jay actually spent 3+ years on Mercy ships. This is a hospital ship that travels from port to port around the world. We get into that in the beginning of this interview, and we talk about some of the intensity that came with that experience.
You're living in this pressure cooker where everything does happen faster and slower. So you have 6 months of experience that normally you would maybe pack into a decade. The things that you see, the highs and the lows, all of it.
You'll hear about some of the tragic and magic things he witnessed during his time with Mercy Ships and how those experiences still shape him today and led to this crazy life as an expat in Paris. Talk about his transition to quote-unquote regular life before finding that visa loophole that allowed him to move to Europe, how to make a living on YouTube with less than 100,000 subscribers, how he does that. Loads more. It's just a fascinating conversation, and I'm excited to share it with you. So buckle up, strap in. Thanks for being here, and welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend.
You're listening to the Zero to Travel podcast, where we explore exciting travel-based work, lifestyle, and business opportunities, helping you to achieve your wildest travel dreams. And now your host, world wanderer and travel junkie, Jason Moore.
Hey, what's up? It's Jason here with ZeroToTravel.com. Welcome to the show. Thanks for hanging out, letting me bring a little travel into your ears today. This is the show to help you travel the world on your terms to fill your life with as much travel as you desire, no matter what your situation or experience. Of course, today's guest, as I mentioned, Jay Swanson. He's an American writer and blogger. Came to Paris on this visa nobody ever heard of. He'll talk about that in the show. He then started his vlog, started documenting life in Paris. And this has led him to become a local, trusted travel expert. He shares some of those great recommendations with you today. Learn more about him at jswanson.me. That's where you can get all the links to his Paris in My Pocket guide, his popular YouTube channel. You get a behind-the-scenes look at life in Paris. Of course, plenty of local travel tips and all that good stuff. So check out that website. We'll link up to it in the show notes. Stick around on the back end of this show. I'll leave you with a great quote about Paris from somebody who I can't believe I haven't quoted this person before. And I'll share one of my memories from Paris. It didn't take place in the city, actually. It could have taken place anywhere, but it took place in Paris. Fun little story. Stick around for all that on the back end. For now, please enjoy my conversation with Jay Swanson, and I'll see you on the other side, my friend. Cheers.
You know, the beauty of this, Jason, is just time flies when I'm with you.
Likewise. I mean, listen, I know we only met 30 minutes ago, and I know we've only been talking about microphone and audio settings, but I already feel like we're connected, man.
Yeah, we go way back. Like I said, that 30 minutes, it's a pressure cooker.
Behind the scenes at the Zero to Travel podcast, where we're tackling all kinds of tech issues. We're going to start a new show, Jay. Should we
tackling tech to travel?
Tackling tech and travel with Jay and Jay. Jay Swanson, welcome to the Zero to Travel podcast, my friend. Thanks for being here.
Dude, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure. I mean, you're a fellow expat, so we have a lot to talk about today. And we are going to get into the Paris tips because, you know, in 2022, according to the World Travel and Tourism Council, Paris was the most visited city. Highest direct travel and tourism contribution to GDP, like $31 billion or something in tourism. Like, that's insane. So you're carving out your little slice of that, aren't you, Jay?
It's a very little slice, actually. When you start putting numbers like that to it, it's like, wow, I gotta get to work.
$35 billion, sorry, roughly $35 billion.
Just $35 billion.
Yeah, a few more billion. I will link to that stat so people can see. We're gonna get tips and some of the advice I want to fish for, perhaps when you're sharing advice on how to tackle a city like Paris, one of the more popular and bigger cities to visit in the world. We might be able to translate that some visiting some other cities as well.
I was gonna say apparently the biggest, so apparently the most popular.
I want to ask you, man, about Mercy ships. You were working on Mercy ships for 3 years. Like, that would be a really powerful experience, or like transformative experience. Can you just explain what it is? And yeah, I'd like to hear more about your experience and what you were doing there.
Yeah, for sure. Thanks for asking. I volunteered from the end of 2010 to early to mid 2014. And Mercy Ships basically operates the world's largest charity hospital ship. Now they have two of them, which is a mobile surgical unit. So they have multiple operating blocks on the ship, and it serves as hospital and village. It's basically just as self-contained as it can be. So they're able to come in and set up shop and start doing surgery as quickly as possible. There's a lot of groundwork that gets done before they show up. They don't just roll in. There's years of work that goes into it ahead of time. But then when they come in, they've got their specialties lined up. They've got their surgeons coming in with the teams to support them. And they just crank through it. So it's everything from maxillofacial surgeries, cataracts. There's a dental clinic. You have orthopedics, plastics, all kinds of stuff, and crazy things that you would never, ever see in developed countries. Just problems that happen because there's not access to adequate medical care. So it's going in and trying to provide a solution for that and some training and leave the place in better shape than they found it.
What were some of the things you saw that stuck with you? And 3 years is a long time. Were you at sea on this ship for 3 years, or was it like X amount of months a year, or how did that?
Yeah, so the ship, because the goal is to keep it in operation as much as possible. So you go in and you take up an entire berth. That's why you also have to work at basically the presidential level with each country, because you're taking up a berth in their port, which they probably only have one for a given period of time. So that's a huge economic commitment from the country. But you go in and you dock for either 5 months or 10 months. And then that's where you are. You're there. You live in that city, that country for that period of time, and do the work. So the wind up and wind down gets faster all the time. They're getting much more efficient at that and just trying to see as many patients as they can.
I mean, what were some of the things you saw that you still carry with you?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of stuff. I don't know how intense we want to get on this call, but it's the first time I saw people die. It's the first time I've seen and been involved in some of those kinds of traumatic situations where things got out of hand. But also just day to day, I think it's amazing what can get done. I think you see like people with goiters. I'm sure maybe you've seen pictures of people with goiters or very small, like what should be a small, benign, like almost a tooth enamel problem that grows out of control to the point that it becomes a tumor that consumes someone's entire jaw. You know, kids with all kinds of stuff like that. And I think the cool thing is that it's stuff that you'd have to go look up to see. You're never going to come across it yourself. And then the amazing thing is just kind of seeing the result of what surgery can offer, and the number of things, everything from something very visual like that to something very invisible, like a fistula. And women that have given birth and had a fistula could not get it repaired, and then as a result end up leaking and are cast out of their village, cast out of society, basically, because they are always wet and they always stink. And so to be able to go in to repair that, I'm obviously not the one repairing it, but to see that then we're able to give them, you know, a brand new dress, a dry, clean, brand new dress. There's a ceremony with that, and then sending them back out to hopefully reclaim their place in the town that they were effectively run out of or hidden from for so long. You know, I think that it's pretty dramatic because it's not instantaneous, but it's about as close to an instantaneous change as you can get. So seeing people's lives change like that almost on a daily basis, I think is pretty mind blowing.
I mean, I'm sure you have light moments with your colleagues and your fellow volunteers and everything like that, but you're seeing, I mean, I don't know. Yeah. What is that?
Well, it's like the 30 minutes you and I spent together working on the tech problems at the beginning here. It's an intense moment you share with somebody and it compresses that time so that you're like, how did that pass both so quickly and so slowly? I think that there's like this heightened level of that was, I don't mean to, you know, make light of it, but at the same time, I think you're living in this pressure cooker where everything does happen faster and slower. So you have 6 months of experience that normally you would maybe pack into a decade. The things that you see, the highs and the lows, all of it, you know, like I think it took me a long time to get down from the adrenaline high, like, or maybe my dependency on it afterwards, just because it felt like at least weekly, if not more regularly, you're just in a situation that you'd never been in before or something that was genuinely dangerous. You know, like I found myself in a variety of, I mean, I don't want to make it sound more dangerous than it actually is, but you know, I found myself in like riots, or I crashed my motorcycle very far away from anyone in help, or, you know, stupid stuff too. In my early 20s, just like, you know, I wonder if I can climb that rusty old tower over there. I don't think anybody's going to stop me. Let's see how high up I can get. So I think at the end of the day, like, yeah, there's a weird time compression that happens with all of that. And I think that in some ways I'm still decompressing from that. I actually just went to Freetown, which is the first city that I ever lived in West Africa. And it's still the most intense place I've ever been. And part of the reason that I wanted to go back was I had an opportunity. The new ship is there. I have some surgeon friends that are there and some other staff. And I promised them if it got there, when it got back, I would go back to visit. And for me, there was a lot that happened in Freetown. Freetown was a really great, but really traumatic series of experiences for me. And so I kind of wanted to go back just to see, is it still as insane as I remember it? Was that just baby Jay? Was that because I'd just gotten thrown in the deep end and I had no idea what I was doing? And it's very much like being a toddler. Like the first few months, I felt like, I'm sure if any of your listeners have ever learned another language, when you start to immerse yourself in a language for the first time, like your brain power is so over exerted every day that you get to the end of the day and you just fall right asleep. And then you're kind of in this tunnel vision. So if you can imagine that, but like instead of it being a language, it's like the entire environment around you is completely new. The sights, the smells, the people, the everything. You're relearning so many things that you're not even aware you had to relearn. You just always took for granted. The first few months of that, I was just in tunnel vision. I would follow whoever was right in front of me that knew what they were doing and just do what they did and hope for the best. And so like, I'm really, you know, I'm proud of that. And I'm glad that I did that, but it was a lot. And so I was just kind of curious, like, if I go back, will my impressions of Freetown have changed? You know, like, will going back and not feeling that way, knowing that I can make my way around, that I'm effectively like an able-bodied and accomplished traveler at this point. How do I interact with this place that to me is the craziest place I've ever been? And it's still the craziest place I think I've ever been, but like, yeah, I definitely saw that growth in myself. But it's the reason why, like when I've traveled in India and so forth, I'm always like, I'm disappointed by the traffic. I'm like, you guys said the traffic was bad here. Like, what is this? So like, it's that kind of stuff where I'm just like, okay, like it's not totally crazy. It's not just me being a baby. That was definitely part of it, but like, yeah, it's still pretty bananas.
Yeah. So you were going back to use it as a measuring stick, if you will, against your self-knowledge, perhaps.
Yeah, well, I think the only way you can tell if you're growing is by measuring, right? Like you can only, whether that's like emotionally or in some, like just how you react to things. Like if you come up against the same circumstances or the same environment, that's the only way to tell if you've grown. Because if your reaction is the same, then you haven't. If your reaction has changed, then you've changed and then you've grown. So I think for me, I'm in a place in my life where on the far end of the spectrum, it's equally uncomfortable, but on the far end of the spectrum, I went back for my 20-year high school reunion this year. And same thing, I was like, what is this going to be like? And who am I going to be in the midst of this? Like with all these, you know, these kids that I grew up with. So I'm kind of in that place, maybe this isn't a regular, maybe it's a form of midlife crisis. I don't know. But like, I'm just like, I want to know myself. I really want to know myself. And the only way to do that is by putting myself in, you know, familiar, but not necessarily the most comfortable of situations.
You know, isn't that one of the core underlying values of people that travel in the way that people listening to this show are or have or want to, the driving force to know yourself in a way?
I would hope so. Yeah. I think for me, it absolutely has been. Yeah. How about you? Is that the way that you've approached travel?
Yeah. I don't know. Sometimes it was a byproduct of travel. Maybe early on more, it was a byproduct than as it got later, the scale started tipping more in that direction, I suppose.
I think that's true for me too, though. I think when I left, I always had the itch, you know, and I like wanted to go, I wanted to see. I don't think I recognized how much I wanted to know myself. And I definitely didn't recognize how much I was running from things that I couldn't or didn't know how to handle yet, you know? So for me, travel was like, there was an adventure to it. There was something, I knew there was more to me, and I knew that I could not express that or be my fullest self if I didn't go. But at the same time, I think there were a lot of things that drove me to hit the road that like I only became aware of much later. And I don't know if that's the same for you, but I imagine that in that process of self-discovery, it's almost like the value of travel reveals itself to you more after you've done it than on the front side.
When you throw a hand grenade into your cultural constructs, it's kind of impossible not to find something in the rubble afterwards. We'll get back to the interview in just a moment. This episode of Zero to Travel is presented by the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. From muddy jungle paths and snowy trails to rolling sand dunes, the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder has the capability to take you to some of the most epic destinations on Earth. We're excited to partner with Nissan because our listeners know we love to celebrate the joy of exploring the world and finding the best off-the-beaten-path destinations to visit. And there's no better vehicle for that than the 2024 Nissan Pathfinder. With 7 drive modes, the Pathfinder's available intelligent 4x4 is built for even the most epic journeys, and it even has the best towing capacity in its class, up to 6,000 pounds, so you can bring the fun with you. But Nissan also knows that it's not just about where you go. In a Pathfinder, the real fun comes from getting there, and that's something we love celebrating here on the Zero to Travel podcast. We believe that life is about finding that joy within the journey itself, and that's why we're thrilled to partner with Nissan to celebrate adventurers everywhere. So thanks again to Nissan for sponsoring this episode of Zero to Travel and for the reminder to chase bigger, better, more exciting adventures and enjoy the ride along the way. Learn more at NissanUSA.com. Intelligent four-wheel drive cannot prevent collisions or provide enhanced traction in all conditions. Always monitor traffic and weather conditions. Towing capacity varies by configuration. See Nissan Towing Guide and Owner's Manual for additional information. Always secure cargo. Now, back to the show. The traumatic experiences in Free City, can you talk about any of those?
Yeah, I mean, I can. I actually wrote about this in my book. I wrote a book about how I got to Paris, and it's kind of the anti-Paris book, because I think most people's Paris books are very like romantic and upbeat and like, I don't know. There's a rose-tinted glass to it. That,
chasing
like,
the literary dream and, you know.
Oh, 100%. Like, I'm going to be Hemingway. And it's like, don't eat pigeons, whatever you do. Don't. I think for me, like, I definitely have been on this road to just figuring out who I am. And it's been a hard one. And one of the stories that I told in there was probably one of the most seminal moments of my Mercy Ships career. I know it was the turning point for the organization, because what they used to do in screening, when you're doing triage, when you're trying to find your patients, they would do these massive national screening days. So they would actually rent out or be given access to like the national football stadium. So the biggest place that they could get for a couple of days, however long it took to like, a little more than that. Obviously, you have to lock it down and so forth. But the local police would help with that.
And this is to determine who is going to be able to get on and get these free surgeries.
100%.
That must be quite an event.
Dude, it's a it's really cool and really sad all at the same time.
Right. You know? You have to turn people away. I mean, that's gosh.
And at multiple stages, like there's like multiple points of filtration of people that are increasingly like experts. So the newbies like me, I wasn't actually doing it that day. I wasn't supposed to be anywhere near the front that day. But basically, and in the future, what I would do to help. And then you find this when you live in a country anyways, and everyone gets to know what the big white ship in the harbor is for. Everyone comes to you with their medical stuff. And so you kind of really quickly learn like how to do that, like be able to figure out like yes or maybe or no. But also at the same time, you have to be like, yeah, I can't say yes. But like I can get you in touch with the screening team and so forth. So the big national screenings, huge, huge day, thousands of people. I think there were 6,000 or 7,000 people. I don't remember the exact number that were there waiting for us when we got there. So you start before dawn, you know, you're shuttling people from the ship to the stadium. And the thing about Freetown, when I was talking about traffic, I wasn't kidding. Like it's gotten better this last trip. They've done a couple things to make it a step better in a lot of the city, but like it was just bananas. So part of the reason you had to go before dawn was you had to get out before the city started. You had to move a lot of people to the stadium and then back and do multiple runs. So I started the day driving in, you know, Land Rovers, taking nurses and whoever else to the stadium. And then I was supposed to be on this, like, kind of like a musical team at the end. Like there were multiple stations. There was like a prayer team that was there to pray with people who got turned away. And then there was a station for the music as well. And I don't exactly remember how the organization worked. I just remember being like, kind of like, why am I here? Like, I don't really play guitar, but they gave me a guitar and now I'm supposed to sit here all day. This feels kind of tragic. And so I was at the end of the line doing that and things just kind of started to fall apart. And they came in and they're like, hey, things aren't going well at the front. Like people are kind of agitated. We think maybe some music would help. Can you guys go like take your instruments and go like play at the main gate? So this is a main gate.
How much guitar did you know how to play at this point?
I mean, I could play my basic chords.
Okay.
You know? I could fudge it around like you, but I'm definitely not selling tickets. So like I got to the front and it was crazy. I was like, I thought I had this image in my head of like a gentle ramp of like, you know, kind of like an entrance and people just kind of getting a little bit like, we got there and it was like a vibe of like, of sheer desperation. Like it was that people, they had lines that had been created and were supposed to be maintained. Everybody had just crushed through those ropes. They're getting pushed from behind. What we found out later, which is not a surprise as I got to know the city, there are multiple police divisions, some of which only make their money like by enforcing whatever rules they decide to enforce that day. And so there were like cops on the outside that were just like beating people and like making it worse. That you had a bunch of former child soldiers in the crowd that were like maybe there for real reasons, but were kind of like there. They were hyping people up and getting like competitive about getting to the front. So things just kind of started to fall apart. And I just remember getting out to the front of that gate and being like, I do not want to be here. Like this is not good. This is not safe. And somebody's like, we need a chair for the djembe player. And I volunteered to go get that. So I ran to go get the chair, just being like, what have we gotten ourselves into? And by the time I got back, everybody had been pulled back out because the press of the crowd had gotten all the way up to the gates. And if they hadn't pulled everybody out, then they wouldn't have been able to get them out. So they're like, well, just get up on top of the arch above the main gate and you can, you know, play your music up there. And I was like, I can't hear myself shout. How is anybody going to hear my guitar? So we get up there and I just ended up like, and that for me, like just watching from that vantage point, watching everything just slowly devolve to the point that like people started like pushing and like shoving, whatever. It was, you couldn't call it a stampede because there was just so much inertia that the pressure built up on the doors below us that they broke through the locks and whatever had them pinned into the ground and just a flood of people fell through to the other side. And so you have this stampede of people that run through, these guys that are riling the crowd up, sprinted through like they'd won a race. And just people just piled up underneath us. And it was, speaking of time compressing, it was only a few minutes before we were able to get like the doors closed again and people back on their feet and in a line. And then there were 13 bodies on the ground, passed out. One of the guys died, unfortunately. He died before the stampede. Apparently he asphyxiated just being pushed up against the wall. He had some complicating health issues. And so like I was there and I'd had my, you know, first aid, fireman's training, whatever. I was a trained firefighter for the ship. And so I, you know, carried a couple of people out, put them in the safety position. And all that was just a few minutes, but it felt like an hour, you know, and the whole morning went like that. We were there for a few hours and it felt like days. And so, you know, just going from one thing to another, and I just kind of like was like, well, I'm just a floater now. So I just started helping the leadership team, running around, directing people, evacuating people, running keys, finding things. And I ended up being one of the last four people to leave. Like after the riot police had come, they tried to instill more order. More people had broken through. Like things just kind of were steadily falling apart. And so I just remember being, we were in that last Land Rover out. One of the teams, one of the surgical teams had delayed as long as possible because they were still triaging people as best they could, like just trying to make sure that they could at least get some help, some people. And I just remember being in the back of that. It was in like an open truck Land Rover with a bunch of the last of us. And just like the silence and like some, you know, trying to crack a joke here and there or something, but it really felt like we were leaving like a war zone. Like we just exited a battle. Like I genuinely felt like somebody's going to start shooting. Like I have no idea what's going to happen, but something's going to happen. You know, and so there's so many stories that happened in the middle of that. There's so much that went into that, but that ended up changing how they went about screenings. Cause it was like, they're like, this isn't like, we have to completely reform the system. It's not safe. And they've done a good job of that. And I know some of the people that were in charge of doing that, but there you go. I suffered from PTSD for a while after that. I had no idea that's what it was, but every time I left the ship to go into town for 3 to 6 months, I have no idea. I would just, my heart would be racing and I'd be on high alert, and it didn't change for a long time.
Wow. So, I mean, you were at an event that caused a big organization to reform the way they do it. I mean, that kind of says it all, right? Like it was that bad.
Yeah, it was my first one too. So welcome to the show.
Yeah, I mean, this isn't like you're volunteering at a community garden experience. You know,
that sounds nice.
Yeah, but yet you did this for 3 years, right? I mean,
yeah,
yeah. Well, what? Why did you keep going?
Joking aside, I think because there are so many dark jokes that I could make, but
I mean, I can't imagine it's to climb more rusty towers.
Oh,
right?
Dude, I climbed so many more rusty towers.
Oh, you did? Okay.
I learned so much just from like how the Brits call it blagging, like how to talk your way through anything where you're just like, nah, man, it's cool. Like, I'm fine. Like, I don't know, just coming up with whatever story to be like, I'm going to climb that tower. Yeah, aside from climbing towers, I mean, part of it. So the funny thing was that like I went in, I was already in a like kind of my crisis of faith. And I didn't know it. Everything was kind of coming apart for me in that arena. And what drove me there was partially, I mean, it was during the recession that I joined. I was, part of it was like, I wanted to travel. I wanted some adventure. I wanted to serve. Like I'd always served. I'd always volunteered. I'd always done these things. And I was like, this is a natural extension of that. I didn't know of any other way I was going to go see West Africa. Great way to use my French, I thought. And then I ended up in two English speaking countries right away. Three actually. You know, but like, I think at the end of the day, like there's a commitment to it and there's a sense of community and there's a sense of adventure and there's a sense of actually doing something like positive with your days. Like you're a step removed from it when you're not medical. So like for me, I always struggled with my sense of purpose with the organization because I always felt like I wasn't living up to my full potential as an individual, as I also volunteered with the organization. So that was kind of an internal struggle that I always had. But at the same time, like you see real tangible good that's being done. And as much of a struggle as it is to live in like work and live in a community like that, just because of the proximity that you have with everybody all the time. It's also one of the most rewarding. It's also, yeah, it's a hugely rewarding experience. And then, I think the addiction to the adrenaline, I didn't realize that was happening, but it slowly happened.
Yeah. So was that your kind of gateway drug, let's call it, into world travel?
Not really. I mean, I started before that, but then, you know, it's funny because honestly, like when I got back to, when I finally moved to Paris, actually I was in Paris for a portion of that time anyways, I came to work for the global office in Europe. I remember really struggling to reintegrate into like Paris life because it's like, I'll just go for a walk and then I'll have a coffee and then I'll like, it's so idyllic in so many ways. And that's when I started to realize about, I was joking, but serious about like the adrenaline side of it. where I was like, what am I doing? Like, I haven't had to save anyone's life this month. I haven't like nearly lost my own anytime soon, like recently. It's just like, and you don't feel like whatever you're doing, at least when your days were like rushing by on that hospital ship, you're like, well, like I can see the actual output. Like I see the patients. I see literally the blind see, you know, and the lame walk. And then you go to Paris and people are complaining about literally everything. And it just, there's a huge contrast. And I struggled a lot because I went back to the States for 2 years after I finally finished my time in the Congo. And it was really hard. It was really hard to go back to just kind of regular everyday life. And it took me a while. So gateway drug, not really. It was almost like it was the biggest drug. And then the withdrawals were pretty rough.
The transition from that environment to, let's say, a quote unquote, normal life, if you to use kind of those words, you were what, working, going to work, living somewhere, just kind of living the standard American.
Well, actually, I jumped right into a consulting gig. So I ran for a long time. I was on a plane every like 3.5 days for 2 years. And
a travel job.
It was basically a travel job. I was working on electronic medical records. Okay. For a chunk of time, which was also an interesting life choice.
But it's still business travel, right? I mean, you're...
It was. Yeah. I was getting paid to see the country. I got to see most of the United States that way, which is really good. And I'm really grateful for that. But what I didn't realize was, yeah, again, like I was definitely like, I was not dealing with what I needed to be dealing with. Instead, I was just like hitting the road, like just keep on going. And I think that kind of colored my view of how, at least for me, travel. And I think, I don't know if you've experienced this with the expat community or the immigrant community that you're a part of, but I think that there's a not insignificant portion of us who have left because we don't want to look back. And I think that it's taken me quite a while to get to the place where I'm like, oh no, looking back is exactly what I need to do. Like I need to get this stuff figured out.
I think that juxtaposition you described, you know, where you were coming from, now that you've painted that picture, and getting back into like a business travel job or something like that. This is something I struggle with here and there, and I'm probably more than here and there, and I'm struggling with right now. It's this, because I live in Norway, you know, it's a privileged society. And how do you reconcile this human suffering that groups of fellow humans have to experience, and others get to live in a different way, you know, that's so privileged? I can't get my head around it sometimes, man. I don't mean to have an existential crisis right here on the pod, but...
And I broke the podcast just that quickly. This is the last episode that will ever be recorded.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I feel you, man. That's a big part of why I struggled with, you know, with my faith. I, how do you reconcile the suffering, you know? And on the one hand, I think that, like, you know, we forget that we don't choose this. We don't choose where we're born. We don't choose the family we're born into, the country, the society, the time, any of these things, we're thrown into it. So like, I think I've always taken it on myself. I've always taken a huge personal responsibility. It's one of the big reasons that I went to Africa and volunteered 4 years of my life, was because like, I felt this burden to do something about it. And it's not that I don't think that that's okay, but I think I learned that at the end of the day, like, we should do what we can. We should absolutely be doing everything we can to alleviate suffering and poverty and all of these things. But unless we do that within ourselves first, like, we're not going to actually do as much good as we think we are. And so I guess the hard realization for me was coming to recognize I didn't love myself. I didn't treat myself well. I didn't deal with the poverty, both literal and figurative, in my own life. And that limited my capacity to actually have as much of an impact. So I think that's the first thing. And then my Emily is going to end up listening to this at some point. My assistant and wearer of many hats. She's my right hand, but we have these really long debates about this all the time, because like, I want to be careful. I can have a fairly cynical view of it sometimes, or maybe not cynical, but like a little bit of a downcast view of it. And my focus is very much on like, okay, how do I help the people immediately around me? How do I help benefit the community I'm actually in? How do I make a real difference right here and now? And she does a good job of trying to re-elevate that to like, yeah, but then how do we grow that into helping the rest of the world. And so it's hard. I don't have an answer to it, but I'm definitely trying to find a good balance.
Okay. So what you're referring to, it sounds like, just so I'm clear, is that this sort of internal struggle between, like you described your experience with Mercy Ship, kind of the immediate, I don't want to say gratification, but like sort of the immediacy of being able to have tangible results, as you mentioned, seeing help, it's there, you're present, versus some of the stuff you're doing now, which is like, you know, you're creating a video and putting it out to the world and okay, this will help people, but you don't see them and it's sort of hard to measure the impact. Is that the kind of thing you're referring to? The struggle?
Kind of, I think in a way, my struggle, yeah, I definitely have a struggle with that. So you're hitting that on the head. I wonder if you feel that way with your podcast actually sometimes.
I just try to create like thoughtful conversations and hope that I just kind of trust that people will take from them what they need in that moment in their lives. And then it's really not up to me. It's just, let me just do my job. And that's my job to serve the audience. And whatever that means to them is, that's kind of how I just, you know, we make a podcast like this and then we just let it go. And who knows how it's hitting people's ears. You know, you just never know, but I feel good about it.
That's good. Feeling good about it. That's important. And yeah. I think that it's really good to, it's good to, you know, pull a Rick Rubin and be like, hey, I made it. That's the success. And then let it go. I am still burdened with a little bit of the way that I was raised, I think. And so it stops me from being quite as zen about it. And so I'm working on that. But I think kind of what I'm referring to is the way that I grew up. I, you know, it is that thing of like, we're here to, it was a savior complex. It was like, we're here to save the world. We're here to save people and like all this other stuff. And I think for me, I still kind of struggle with that to some degree when it comes to, I mean, the institutions that we have believe I could go down a really long rabbit hole with this. So I guess I'll just take the easy road and say, yes, basically that's it. And I think that the struggle now is in that, like, how do you value, the work that you're doing today, when it isn't as directly tangible, and also when it doesn't feel as like deeply necessary, you know, like if somebody doesn't find the best coffee in Paris, are they going to be okay? Probably, unless they're Australian, in which case they might never come back. But like, you know, at the end of the day, like, I guess it's taken me a long time to come back to recognizing the value of what I offer. And that's at no fault of my audience and no fault of the people around me. People have been lovely. And like, I've gotten to know so many wonderful people and heard so many wonderful stories about how I've been able to impact their lives. I think it's just an internal thing where it is just that I don't value myself or my own work. And that's ultimately the work that I'm doing on myself to get to that place where I'm like, no, what I'm doing is good. And then I can be more zen like you. And
yeah. Well, I mean, don't give me too much credit, man. It's not like I'm not feeling that zen about it all the time, but I, you know, you just, like you said, I mean, you're trying to, you made the Rick Rubin reference. I mean, you just try to, yeah, make a thing that you feel good about, I think. And then that you feel is going to benefit others in some way and serve the people that are a part of your circle. And then you just kind of let it go. And it's really up to them how they take it in. But it's a real balance, you know, like you say, you got to fill your own cup, and that's a part of it. In order to like serve other people, you got to fill your own cup too, right? It seems to me that you get a lot of joy making these videos about Paris and talking about your love of the place you live and where you've built a life. And
I'm lucky to do what I do. I stumbled into it and very fortunate that it has panned out. And I think it is that thing where when I talk about filling your own cup, I think the reason is, for me, I grew up in a very self-sacrificial way. So it was like the only truly valorous way to serve was to sacrifice yourself, basically, to, you know, to really pour everything out and leave nothing behind. And I've come to realize how much that's held me back. And so I used to say this, and it took me a long time to believe this, but you can't save other people from drowning if you're in the water with them. You know, like, you got to get in the boat and then you pull them into the boat after you. And I mean, unless you're in a swimming pool, then you jump in the water and you pull them out. But if we're talking ocean metaphors here, don't grab onto other people hanging out in the water together. And so that's it. So I think the cool thing is I'm in coaching right now with a guy named Dan, who's phenomenal. And you know, he's always pushing when it comes to serving and when it comes to sharing your story, You have to persevere through these things and you have to figure them out so you can turn around and help the people that are a couple steps behind you. Right. So like that's the other part of it is like, okay, like this is my burden to bear. It's not everybody's, but if I can figure this out and work my way through it, that is also a way of serving because now I can turn around and offer some hope and maybe some helpful tips to be like, hey, I made this mistake. If you want to avoid doing that, I would recommend it. So yeah, I'm wrestling with that a lot too, because it's like, how do you then in a healthy, like really truly beneficial way, serve the community you're a part of and serve broader humanity as a result? Because I'm having to unlearn a lot of really bad habits around how I serve, and integrate healthier ones that then hopefully really do some good in the world. And I'd rather leave it in a better place than I found it, but the jury's still out. So we'll see.
It sounds to me like you've been doing that your whole life. So, I mean, I'll give you some props here from what I'm hearing. You also have to make a living. And ideally, I think there is something to, you know, you do something that's aligned with, you feel like you're serving some purpose, and then you enjoy it and you feel good about it. And then you're able to make a living from it also. And then you're feeling good in general about your daily life and kind of like how things are. And that matters too, you know, and just from a community level, to go back to that. I mean, you're walking out of your apartment or your house or whatever, and you have all these things that are working for you, and then you're giving off this, you know, good energy in your interactions. And I don't know, man, like, how do you measure these things? You know, it's impossible.
Well, that's also part of it, right? Is it's like there's so much that is unmeasurable in being human. And I think that's where we come into a lot of conflict with the way our society is built, because everything's supposed to be efficient and put out like clean numbers and lead to profit. And it's like, well, maybe it's not all about that. Like, I was thinking about that today because my accountant's kind of annoyed with me. He's French. So I, you know, it's not entirely
unexpected,
but his advice would definitely be, you know, like, don't contract anybody in France. It's too expensive. It's a huge burden. Like, you got to do everything you can to keep people freelance and so forth. And that's, you know, from a bottom line business perspective, yeah, that makes sense. Like, you don't want to make so much money and blah, blah, blah. Or you don't want to blow it all on spending, basically just handing it over to the French government. I get it. But you also have to think about your people. Like, it's a cost of like taking care of people. And if it's a goal of yours to then be like, no, I want them to feel secure and supported. I want them to stay. I want them to be a part of my team. You know, like I want them to benefit from the fact that we are here in France, whatever it is. For me, that's then more of a goal. It's like, you know what, honestly, if that means I'm going to take home less of what little I take home anyways, like if that means I'm going to take home less, that's fine. Because like, ultimately, what is the point of having a business if not to build like a better community, a better team, to like keep the people that you love and enjoy close at hand? Like, I don't want to build a business just to extract as much profit from the globe as I can. Yeah, I'd like to make some money. Yeah, I'd like to buy a Paris apartment someday. No, that's not cheap. You know, so like, yeah, I'm becoming more of a realist about it for sure. But I'm trying to hold on to some of that idealism too, where it's like, yeah, man, like I can annoy my very Parisian accountant who will never listen to this. Please God, I hope he never listens to this. But you know, like I can make life a little bit harder for him and for me, in order to make it a little bit easier for the people that are adding so much value to my life. Like I don't know, man. I think that like we find ourselves in this place where everyone's just trying to get as much as they can and give as little as possible. And I'm trying to figure out, how can I give away as much as possible and trust that it's going to come back to me? Because I know I've said that before, or believed in that before, whatever, like, or said I believed in it before, but how do I actually live that? And I think then the cool thing is, even if you don't have a number and there's no easy way to measure it, at the end of the day, like, imagine 5 years from now being surrounded by people that you love and admire and you care about. And like, you like just have this extended family, whether or not, I obviously calling it family can be dangerous in today's age, but like, you just have this extended group of people that love and respect you, that you're, I mean, the measure of a man, right, is taken by his friends, to misquote Ebenezer Scrooge, or at least the Muppet Christmas Carol. I'm not sure which, but like, I think it's that thing. It's like, okay, like, who are the people around me, and how do we feel about each other, and where are we collectively going? What is our trajectory together? And I think that, yeah, there's no way to measure that like directly, but I think you really can have a feel for that. And I think that that's what's been driving me the most for the last couple of years.
Yeah. It sounds to me like a healthy approach, really. Like, you're right. I mean, if you look at it from a status quo perspective, it might be, you know, trying to suck out every last profit if you're looking at it from a business type of perspective. But this is why I think entrepreneurship is like travel in the way that it kind of forces you to assess your values at some point or answer some moral dilemmas or ethical questions. It's just like scenarios arise when you're running your own show and you just have to make decisions. And then inevitably you're running into your moral compass or your whatever, you know, questions around your core values or whatever the case is. I think like as long as you're kind of aligning with your core values, then yeah, it's hard because you take your practical mind and you can look at numbers and profit and all that stuff, but then you know, you're trying to match that up and do it in a holistic way. I suppose it's not always easy.
Well, it's hard. I mean, and then also I think, at least for me, the challenge in this whole like rediscovering my values and so forth, I think there's a level of also asking the question, like, what do I value? Like, what are my values and what do I want? And it's amazing how those questions can actually be really, really foundationally, they can shake you. That's been my experience in the last few years. It's like, I kind of know what I want, or I think I know what I want, but no, like specifically 20 years from now, where are you? What are you doing? How are you living? Who are you with? What does this all look like? Like, and it's incredibly hard, at least it was for me, to really start painting that picture and trying to refine it. So I think if you don't even know that, like if you don't know where you're headed, how do you know if you're making any progress?
We'll get back to the interview in just a moment. Hey, you lovely listeners, Jason here. And did you know we have a newsletter and it's free? You can sign up over at zerototravel.com/newsletter. You're going to get money-saving tips, destination advice, some musings, little personal updates, all the stuff that you don't get right here on the podcast. And we can keep in touch. So sign up over there, zerototravel.com/newsletter. Get your weekly dose of travel value totally free. Thanks for listening. Now, back to the show. Let's talk about Paris. We're here to talk about Paris. I'm sure some of this stuff will circle back. But, you know, this all ties in, man. I mean, this is why I wanted to chat with you about your experience, because I saw Mercy Ships. I had to think, that just sounds like it was probably a very transformative, life-changing experience, which, you know, as we all know, one domino leads to the next in a way. And here you are in Paris doing the work you're doing, and you can't say that you may not have ended up there without the journey beforehand. So I saw on your website, you said my life took some dramatic turns in 2016, and then you moved back to Paris in 2017 with no job on a visa no one had ever heard of. I mean, it's always fun to try to find a visa that nobody's ever heard of. Everybody wants to find the backdoor hack into living in some country. I don't know if that visa still exists, but you can share a bit about how you ended up there. And I want to get into like some core practical strategies, advice, travel tips, all that good stuff.
Great. Yeah. I mean, yeah, 2016. The fun thing is that's when I started vlogging daily. And so if you want to go relive the joy of that period of my life, it was captured every day on camera. Not necessarily well, but I tried.
You learn a lot if you vlog every day for years, right?
I mean, yeah, you learn the value of sleep. Yeah, I learned a lot. Yeah. No, 2016. Basically I had three different ventures that I was kind of had big irons in the fire. So I kind of wrapped up my consulting gig, or was underway of wrapping that up. Like the work was kind of drying up and I was not a huge fan of doing it anymore anyways. So I'd taken what I made and invested that largely into my writing. I wrote a lot of fiction, fantasy and science fiction. Back when I moved to South Africa, I made the commitment to write a book every year for 10 years. And then I was like, I'm going to write and publish this. I decided to self-publish because I don't do anything the easy way, because I just have to learn the hard way, apparently. So I was like, all right, well, I'm going to travel the country. I've got all these air miles. I'm also like, these guys fly me, quote unquote, home. And since I didn't have a home after living abroad for so long, I just went to whatever city in the country I felt like every weekend to visit friends and do whatever. So it's a perfect opportunity to go to like conventions, try to meet readers, try to like, I had this big project that I was doing. So I had this Kickstarter that was going for that. It fell flat on its face. I had a book that I had written for a publisher, one of two. I don't remember if it was the first one or the second one. I think it was the first one that I wrote. I wrote for a publisher, and then they were like, yeah, no. And then I, nice guys, I saw them at a convention years later, and they were like, oh, we can't wait for the next one. It was so good. And I was like, why didn't you buy it? And they're just like, oh, I just didn't have a slot for it for the market that year. But like, yeah, we can't wait to see the next one. I was like, cool. You could have told me that at the time, because it would have crushed my ego a little less. And then this tech startup that I put a lot of time and effort into, and, that also failed. So that was at the beginning of the vlogging. In particular, that one I think was for sure on the vlog. And my whole life had just fallen apart. I overextended myself. Like, I was in so much debt at that point. Like, I hadn't realized I was not good at accounting and all of the reimbursements and everything. You just get kind of lost in the flow of it, using your credit cards to get those points and whatever else. And then re-leveraging whatever you did have to invest in the next business and whatever. And so I put myself in a really bad place. Everything. I was just struggling. I was struggling really hard. And when the tech startup thing was clearly not going to go anywhere, we launched a Kickstarter for that as well. It was a fun experience. Got to go to Taiwan, go to manufacturing, got like to see a lot of really cool things. I was like, well, screw it. Like, I miss Paris. Like, I lived here once before in 2012, and I had a whole bunch of air miles. I had no money, but I had this tiny maid's chamber, which you can see behind me. That I knew I could sleep in, it was available to me. And I was like, screw it, I'll just go for 2 weeks. Like, I've got air miles, let's just go. So I
sounds like the flights. Romantic first arrival to Paris. Like,
there it is.
Yeah.
it's the Hallmark version.
Yeah.
I'm just this poor country boy coming to the big city. And so I landed here and had a fun time. And one of the friends was like, well, if you can get back here, like, I'll get you a job teaching English. And I was like, cool, I'm American. It's not that easy. So I went back and I was looking at visas, and I ended up finding this visa, or I'd heard about it before. It was called Compétences et Talents, which is just like skills and talents visa. And it was good for 3 years. And I was like, well, I might as well try. Like, I don't think I'm going to qualify for this, but I might as well try. So I put my bid in for it. Like, I flew down to San Francisco. I used to live in Washington State. So I was in the San Fran consulate district. Flew down. Went in, and the red flag should have been that when I found it, like, I couldn't find it on their website, but I could if I Googled it. So if I Googled Compétences et Talents San Francisco, it would pop up. And I was like, ah, well, I found it on their website. So I gathered everything, showed up for my appointment, and the guy couldn't find it either. And I was like, no, but if you Google it, you'll find it. And he was like, oh, okay. And he Googled it, and was like, well, it's on our website. So he literally copied and pasted it off of that page, printed what he copied and pasted out, and then processed my visa off that. And he's like, okay, we'll let you know. Meanwhile, I'm like desperate. I'm dying. Like, I'm working whatever minimum wage jobs I can find. I worked a weird litany of jobs. I sold weed legally. I don't know if that just, I didn't want to, I'd never smoked it, but I was like, I will take whatever job. I put furniture together for a guy. I was doing all kinds of stuff. Just trying to keep it afloat. And I was like, where the heck is this visa? And then I found this email, and maybe I emailed them actually. And I was like, hey, what's going on? And they're like, oh yeah, we already emailed you last week. And I was like, oh, I'm like, yeah, you're that visa doesn't exist anymore. Like, that's why, like, we can't give it to you. However, there is a new one that's going through the process, and we could forward you on for that if you'd like it. We'll send you down to LA. And I was like, that is the single nicest moment in French bureaucratic history. Normally they would have like mailed my passport back with a Xerox of the guy's middle finger, you know, and that'd have been it. No explanation, nothing. Just like, you know, you, here you go. So like, I was like, yeah, please send it to LA. And then a week later, got a couple questions concerning like finances and stuff. And I was like, oh God, this isn't not the questions I want to be answering, but here we go. And then they sent this very badly worded email that just said, that basically made it sound like, if you were going to land in France, when would you like to arrive? And I was like, well, I still had status with American Airlines. Like, I had an executive platinum status, like the highest level of status. I had no money, but I had this and email. Yeah. So I was like, you know, the cool thing about the
status
is,
you had travel money in a way.
I had travel money. So I was like, I can fly with four oversized bags if I make it before I run out of status. It was like, I think it was February like 14th or something. And my status ran out at the end of February that year. So I was like, I would like to arrive on March 1st, please. I'll get a ticket for February 28th. So I just booked that ticket, not knowing if I was going to get to go or anything like that. Started packing my bags. A couple days later, my passport shows up. They didn't tell me anything about this visa. They didn't tell me how long it was good for. They didn't tell me what it was called. They didn't tell me what I was allowed to do. They didn't tell me anything. The first time I saw it was when I opened it up and I found this big fat visa in my passport and it just said passport talent. And I was like, is that redundant intentionally? Or like, is that the name of this thing? I don't understand. And so I was like, well, screw it. I'm going to go. So I just packed all my stuff, flew over here with like 100 kilos, like 220 pounds of stuff. And just moved my life over here and then showed up and was just like, so can I work? I was just like, I'm just going to keep going with this and hope that nobody calls my bluff. And so
this is like that episode of Seinfeld where, like Kramer just shows up to work where he doesn't really work and he just keeps showing up. Or there's another one with George where he just pretends it never happened. Like he never got fired, you know, same kind of thing. You just show up and you're just like, all right, I guess let's just keep going with this ruse and see how far we can take it. Here we go.
Send me a paycheck. Let's see how it goes.
I mean, moral of the story, it sounds like, you know, hey, you never know with the visas, right? You might be able to find a little loophole if you get in front of the right people.
Yeah. And the very much the right people. That was really lucky. Because later, it's like turned out to be, so it took a year to finally get it solidified. And I suffered the most abuse from the immigration system because I would go in. I had to go in like every 3 months for a year and sit in this room. Everybody, if you've ever moved to France, any of your listeners that have ever lived in France have had to go to a place called the prefecture, which is the police headquarters, because they're in charge of immigration for whatever area you're in. They're going to process your visa. And I had to go and they put me in like this room off to the side, whatever, with a bunch of people that I guess had been deemed undesirable. And every time I went up, they would just be like, we don't know why you're here. Like, why are you here? What are you doing? Like, why did they give this to you? And I was like, I know as much as you do. Aren't you supposed to just stamp it? Just give it to me. Hours. I would spend like 8 hours in there and it was just misery, absolute misery. So that happened for a year. And then finally they were like, you're not even supposed to be here. You're supposed to be in a different office. Cause they didn't know. Like when I arrived, I wasn't kidding when I said nobody had heard of it. When I arrived in France on March 1st in 2017, I got to go through like the fancy line and stuff for like the last time in my life. And I got up to immigration and she looked at my passport and then looked at me and then looked at the visa again and then looked at me and squinted and was just like, you're lucky you're American. And then hand wrote the information off the visa down and gave it back to me. She's like, I don't know what that was, but like, welcome to France. And so I was like, okay. And came in. And then for a year with the people who are supposed to know what they're doing, immigration wise, they just like looked at me like, we don't understand why you're here. We don't think you deserve to be here. Why don't you go back to where you came from? And so then finally a year later, a complete year, like I did not get that visa finalized for almost exactly a calendar year. It might've been exactly a calendar year. Again, that's in my vlog if you really want to go suffer with me, but they're like, you have to go up there. So they put me up in the room with all the people with the fancy, like white people jobs that like, you know, like these are all like teachers and financiers and I don't know what. And the head of that department came in and she was like, I've heard about you. And like takes me to some like desk no one's using, sits down, goes through my whole dossier. And thankfully by that point, like my YouTube channel had started to gain a little bit of traction. And like I'd applied based on my writing, which was tenuous at best. And then I think my YouTube stuff kind of saved me. She's like, yeah, I get it. Like, just like, because I was teaching English, I was translating and doing voice acting. I was doing all this stuff just to survive. Like I wasn't making, you know, enough money anywhere because I was still under a mountain of debt. And she's like, yeah, I get it. Okay, you can stay. And all so right. that was my romantic meet cute with France.
I mean, you had the talent visa and then you just had to get there and put your talents to use and eventually it paid off. Congratulations. I mean, yeah.
Speaking of blagging, see all that climbing up Rusty Towers, just got to talk your way through, man. Just got to don't back down.
Yeah.
Just believe you belong.
All right. Well, we're going to tackle trip planning. And again, maybe along the way, you can keep your ears open if you hear any kind of universal advice that can help you plan to any popular big cities. I'll focus on Paris, of course. And we're going to go through some of the things like, you know, where should we go? What should we do? We're going to talk about off the beaten path type of activities, maybe things I'm going to ask you if things are maybe overrated or underrated, where we should stay and things like that. But I want to start where perhaps these destination type of episodes should always start, which is how you meet locals. Because I feel like in my experience, at least, whenever you meet a local early and they take you under their wing or something, all whatever plans you made completely change in like a great way, right? Like you still might go see the main sites you wanted to see, but you end up doing a bunch of things that you wouldn't have ended up doing and end up at a bunch of like bars or restaurants or whatever that you wouldn't have ended up at because you're with a local and they're like inviting you along, tagging you along. Of course, that's like the travel experience, one of the ones you want to have, you know, when you're traveling. So maybe we can start there because the perception of the French is that they don't like, well, Americans specifically. I'm just stereotyping here. I'm not saying it's this way. You can tell us, you know, it could be standoffish or whatever the case is, you know. You don't speak French, you're not going to get anywhere, all that kind of stuff. You know, don't even bring up the freedom fries. You know, that's an old reference, but all right. So yeah,
this conversation is over.
So let's start with connecting with the French. How do we do that?
That is hard. I would not start there personally.
Well, we're starting there, Jay. Come on, get on board with this.
I'm on board. I'm on board with helping people succeed at having a great time in Paris. And well, the thing is that it's changed a lot. Paris has changed a lot. When I first lived here over a decade ago, like English was a lot harder to come by. People were way less willing to meet you in the middle and try to help you out with that. And now, especially with like younger generation, like millennials, Gen Z, like people are going to be very ready to way more often, especially in Paris. They're pretty excited to speak English. Not everyone. I'm not going to go on a limb and say everyone is, but like people are a lot more thoughtful and like ready for that than they used to be. English has made its way into the popular culture so much here. It's crazy. It's changed a lot. So it's definitely a different landscape. Some of those stereotypes are unfortunately going to ring true to some degree, but there's like a good cultural reason below that. One is that like they don't hate Americans. They love Americans. It's just like Americans and French don't always interface properly. And that comes down to like the number one thing that I would always tell anyone to do when they come to France, which is you have to say bonjour. If there's any word you learn before you come to France, that's it. You just have to be able to say hello, bonjour,
it's
in French.
Fun to say, too. Bonjour.
It's so much fun to say. You can make it sing-songy. Yeah. You can, like, overemphasize the R to try and get that to work. You can, like, there's so much you can do with it.
Yeah.
And the thing is that with the French, like, their businesses, their restaurants are an extension of their home. There's an element of that where, like, you are coming into my home. So there's a politesse that has to start. And that is just by acknowledging that by saying bonjour. Whether you're in a bakery, a restaurant, a shop, wherever it is, that's where you start. And then things will warm up pretty quickly. But most people, when they run into problems meeting French people, it's because they don't start that way. They jump right into business or they ask a question or whatever it is. And they skip that magic word. And then the ice starts to form. So I'd say it forms pretty quickly, depending on who you're talking to. So like that one word will make a big difference. And then just making any lame effort to speak any French will go a long ways because there's a lot of pride in the language and there's an expectation that people should speak it that is changing. They're coming to realize that they may not have won the linguistic global battle, but at the same time, it's not like going to a Nordic country where no one expects you to speak Norwegian or Swedish or Dutch or anything like that. They're just like, no, you have to speak English. We get it. The French aren't that way. So I think just that one word will change your experience. And then as far as meeting people goes, and actually the reason that that's also culturally more challenging is because the French have kind of three circles of friends, by and large. This is a generalization, but they have the friends they grew up with, the friends they went to secondary school with or whatever, you know, college, whatever we call college. I don't even know if we call it secondary school. I'm lost. And then they have their work friends. Those are the three groups of main friends that they have. And they don't even mingle those groups of friends. The only time you meet people that are in a different circle of friends is at like a wedding or a funeral or maybe a birthday party. But even then, they'll probably have different birthday parties for different groups of friends. They just don't mingle. So you go to a bar in France, nobody's there to do the small talk. You stand in line to get a croissant. Nobody wants to hear the joke that you're going to make when you're like, hey, that one looks like a cow. I don't know. Like whatever it is, like the stuff that you do as an American, at least stuff that I used to miss about just like sharing random jokes and comments and whatever. Yeah, it just doesn't fly here in the same way. And it's not that they don't necessarily enjoy it. They're just not equipped for it. Like, there are a lot of French people that would love to do small talk. They just don't know how.
Very, very so, similar in Norway here.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's kind of, it makes you feel a little bit like sad and lonely sometimes, doesn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, it does. I miss the American small talk.
Yeah. You never thought you would, but then you're like, wow,
yeah.
I miss this. Then you live abroad long enough and you're like, is this for real? Like, then you start, then you become a little more European and you're like,
right.
Why are these people talking to me? I don't understand.
Yeah, but I mean, that's a great tip. Just bonjour and start there and kind of build the connection. And, you know, we can all learn a simple few phrases, even if that phrase is, I'm sorry, I don't know how to speak French, but,
yeah,
you know,
well, as a visitor, that's what I was going to say. Like, the tricky thing is that, so all that cultural pretext was to say that the easiest way to mingle with people that live here is probably going to be in a more English-speaking environment to start. Like, if you want to find a buddy who's going to take you around, you're more likely to do that like at an Irish pub than you are in like a wine bar. Because in the wine bar, again, people aren't going to be turning and talking to you. And you might be able to break that down. If you're a friendly, outgoing person and you're polite and you don't speak too loudly, like you make yourself, you know, you're just your charming self. You might meet people everywhere you go because the French are open to meeting people. They do like travelers. They love it when people try to speak French. And like the more that you can sing whatever praises of wherever it is you are, you know, everybody loves that wherever you're going. Like if you go to any city in the world and you tell them how great their city is, they're going to love that. They're going to start telling you how it's not great if they're Parisian, but like, they're also going to like, they're really going to appreciate that. So like doing you, I guess maybe the thing is if you're going to meet French people, you just have to be ready to be a little bit more muted culturally than Americans tend to be just to not scare them away. And then be generous and put in the extra effort up front and see what comes back to you. Because then there are so many great stories of people meeting local French people when they're here. And half the time, I don't even know how they did it. And it's just like, this is amazing. Like you just gotta kind of approach it a little bit differently.
Yeah. It's so true that when you compliment somebody's town, whether they are going to go against it or not, it is a great way to either get people excited or create a conversation. Okay, so where should we stay and what should we do?
100%. One last point on those staying and doing, though, is that also ask questions. Like if you'd be surprised how many good conversations can start just by saying, hey, you live here. Where should we go to do X?
Yes, absolutely.
Even if you know the answer. Even if
everybody
you know exactly
loves to give their personal recommendations. You get excited
Everyone
about
loves
it.
Giving
it gives
their
you good vibes, you know? You're like, oh, I had this experience. You got to have this. It's great, you know?
100%. I loved being here. I want to know more. Where would you go? What would you do? And I think that's actually the fastest way probably to start both. You'll start making inroads that way faster than any other way probably is just to start asking questions. So where should you stay and what should you do? For me personally, I always say stay central, like draw a circle around Notre Dame and stay there. So that can be in any of the first six arrondissements. And then that's probably the best. If it's your first time in Paris, that's what I would say. I always also say don't stay near the Eiffel Tower. That is like one of the most searched things. Everybody wants to stay near the Eiffel Tower. There are two reasons not to. One is that half of the hotels with Eiffel Tower in their name are nowhere near the Eiffel Tower. So unless you know your geography well enough, people get suckered into this all the time. They stay in some place that's like 2 miles away from the Eiffel Tower and it just has the name in the hotel. And then they're disappointed to discover, no, it's not near the Eiffel Tower. Secondly, even if you can stay near the Eiffel Tower, unless you really love the 7th, which is the 7th and the 15th, which are the Eiffel Tower is in the 7th, the 15th is bordering it, have a lot to offer. They're actually really wonderful. The 7th is very old money. It's very like big boulevards, beautiful buildings. But the majority of the kind of stuff that I personally would love to do and that I recommend people do is nowhere near there. It's not the most vibey, fun, like forward-thinking, best food, best drinks, best coffee kind of arrondissements. So the Eiffel Tower is a place you go visit it, but you time it so that you don't have to eat anywhere near it. The last thing you want to do is be hungry by the Eiffel Tower because you're just going to, I mean, unless you want to eat a crepe, that, you know, go for that. But otherwise, yeah, I wouldn't do that.
Okay. All right. What should we do?
So many things.
Yeah.
What do you like to do?
I mean,
what
well, you know, that's always the question. But, you know, outside of the obvious things, let's say when people are planning a trip to Paris, they're probably going to see Notre Dame. They're going to go to the Eiffel Tower. They're going to go to the Louvre. You know,
yep,
most
those
likely.
Are all worth it. I would say that it depends on how long you're in town for. So there are certain things that like if you're here for a very short period of time, I would definitely pick the one thing you have to do and then maybe just see the rest from the outside. Obviously, Notre Dame, you can't see from the inside right now. We're hoping by the end of this year. Macron's promising for the Olympics. We shall see. But in the interim, yeah, I think there are very few things that like Paris does that are oversold, depending on what we're talking about. The Champs-Élysées, I would avoid. You go see the Arc de Triomphe and then skip the walk down the hill because like it's just a strip mall at this point. It's nothing special. They wrote a song about it a long time ago and it lost all of its credence from there. All of its credence? You know what I mean? All of its credibility. I'm personally, for me, like I like to travel by coffee and food and drinks and then sprinkle the monuments and whatever else in between. And if I only see a couple of like the big things in any city, generally pretty happy as long as I had a good time wandering on my own. So for me, like if I'm the part of the reason I say stay central is because you're going to get a lot of very easy walking access to a lot of things that you're going to want to see. The Louvre, Notre Dame, the Luxembourg Gardens, like so many nice things. You'll be in the Marais within 15 minutes of walking, you know, like you're going to be able to see a lot of great stuff, but then you want to go north. And you want to get into the right bank. You want to get into the third arrondissement, the 10th arrondissement, the 11th arrondissement. That's where all the good food is. Like everything that's happening, unless you want to really eat escargot, which nobody here eats, or if you'd like to eat frog legs, which nobody here eats, then you're going to have to go find a touristy spot that's like angling towards that because they know tourists are looking for it. However, if you want to see like the latest trend in like what French bistros do have to offer on the French food side, or you want to see some really good Vietnamese food, or you want to like try whatever the French are doing with smash burgers these days, which is getting actually pretty good. Their burger game was horrible 10 years ago, and now it is like world class. Or you want to get into like some of the best coffee, those are the arrondissements you're going to want to get into.
Okay. Say which ones again. So
you're going to want to get into 3, 10, and 11.
Okay, 3, 10, and 11. So we circle those on the map, and we just show up at one of the metro stations there and get
show
out.
Show up hungry. Yeah.
Show up hungry.
I would definitely show up at like Oberkampf. Like there's so many places. I can't even so if I were to highlight Oberkampf is a really good starting point for a neighborhood. So many great places to have natural wine, craft beer. Your coffee scene is really good. So much good food. I would just drop a pin on that and then you're not going to go hungry.
Okay. If you're going to do, and I find this is something, I don't know if other people do this, but you know, if you're traveling on a budget, but you might have like one splurge meal where you're just like, I'm going to go all out and experience this. Like, not that you're not going to eat out other times, but you're going to go nuts with one. Like you're going to spend a good amount of money. You're going to go to an expensive dinner. You don't have to necessarily tell us one particular place, although you can, but you know, what should you order? How much would we spend on like a splurge meal? And out of those three neighborhoods, where should we go?
Well, if you're in luck, my buddy Dan will be doing his pizza at Rigmarole, which is already completely sold out, but it is the best pizza that I've literally ever had in my life.
Okay.
As somebody who has a pizza tattoo. And
you have a pizza tattoo?
I do.
Okay.
I can show you. Your audience won't be able to see it, but there you go.
Yeah, is that a slice?
It is a slice of pizza with some melted cheese.
Nice.
It's my sister and my sibling tattoo.
Did they have the same one?
Yeah, she and I have the same tattoo. I have it. I have the circle around it. She doesn't.
I love it.
Yeah, it was her. It was her idea, and she gets full credit for that. It was a good.
My
good
sister has a tattoo that just says snacks. She likes snacks.
That's amazing. I kind of want a snacks tattoo now. That's incredible. So Dan, I mean, and that would run you a little bit because those pizzas, he makes this amazing sourdough pizza he's been perfecting for years now. And he only does it in a pop-up, unfortunately. But usually the big spender is going to be kind of like anywhere, I guess. It'll end up being wine, depending on how much you're drinking. Wine can get pretty nuts, especially if you like natural wine. It can get silly pretty quickly. I mean, conventional wine can as well. But I would say that like the prices have gone up. With that experience, I don't know what they're doing this time around, but like we would spend about $60 a person with a few bottles of wine and like enough pizza to leave us all feeling pretty ashamed of ourselves. And now it's closer to probably about 80 euros a person. So it's not terrible. Like honestly, like if you were to go Michelin star and whatever else, you could probably end up spending 100, 200 bucks a person pretty easily. But where you end up really paying is alcohol, if you're going to be drinking a fair amount. It's really easy to eat in Paris for like without alcohol. It's really easy to eat here for $40 a person and feel like you've splurged.
What was the name of the pizza place again?
Well, so it's hosted at Rigmarole.
Oh yeah. Okay. Rigmarole, that's right. Yes.
Which is right next door. They have an ice cream and natural wine spot a couple doors down, which got blew up on TikTok last year. And that's called Foldable. That's also very good. If you like ice cream, if you like wine, yeah, you're not, I don't know if you're going to find a better combination in Paris. That's going to be a spot to go. They don't need more hype though. The last thing they need is more hype. So I'll go the other way. Even though I said that like the Seventh is not a place that I personally would end up in. One of my favorite restaurants in the city is there. It's by my buddy Justin and it's called Milagro. And it's a mixture. It's kind of an international cuisine and some international takes on some French classics. He got his Michelin reference this last year. And it's in my video that I did on the Seventh, this last run. But it's cool because I actually used to highlight his cafe that he has because he's got the best breakfast burrito in town just around the corner at his coffee shop called Zia. And then if you go in to Milagro, which is around the corner, years ago, like when I was vlogging, like he had just gotten the space, they were doing a demo. So like you can go back and see old videos where we're walking through and the place is just trashed. And now it's, yeah, it's a Michelin referenced, super awesome restaurant that also is going to be really good. And also is probably going to run you 60, 80 bucks a person, unless you go crazy on the wine. But super worth it. And his whole staff is super friendly and he's just an amazing, he's an American. He's from New Mexico and just such a good experience. Hmm.
You know, if you want to tap into the vibes of the literary world, the historical epicenter of, you know, expat writing, or you know, we all know the writing history in Paris is, it runs pretty deep. And let's say you just want to, you're like, it doesn't matter if you're a writer, you want to sit down in a journal or you want to write a postcard or the next novel or whatever, you just want to soak up the vibes and try to like get them in. Where do you go to sit down and have a delicious coffee and write a postcard?
And write a postcard?
Yeah, let's say anything, write anything really. Plan out your next version
I
of your
thought
life.
We were going to write the next
write a postcard, write the next novel, whatever. It doesn't matter. You're just going to sit down and you're going to put pen to paper.
Well, the classic spots that people, when they think of all this and they want to go to, is going to be like Les Deux Magots and Café de Flore, which are on the left bank. And they're the most obvious, the most well-known. I personally do not go there. They are nice. Actually, to their credit, because we also often kind of pick on them a little bit, to their credit, their service is really good. Like their staff are great. You'll spend like €6 on a croissant or something ridiculous. Like I think I got a croissant and a coffee and it cost me 12 or 14 euros, something obscene. So not worth it. But that's
so typical Norwegian prices.
Yeah, exactly. We don't spend in kroner here. So I would say like, if you want a place that's actually like fairly chill, you're going to get good coffee, but we can try to stick to the left bank because you probably have like a vibe. You want to be on the left bank at this point. I guess I would probably go with, there are a couple of spots that come to mind, but I would go with Strata on the left bank. The reasons being, so Strata has two locations. One is on the right bank and it's very Marais, very like small, low ceilings, kind of dark, not a lot of natural light. I like it fine. But for writing, you want to go to the one on the left bank because they've got huge windows, lots of natural light, like very nice wood tables. They are accepting of laptops on some tables, which is a problem. It's a challenge if you're actually wanting to write. But if you just come with a postcard or your notebook and you want to sit and have like a pain perdu, which is the fancy way of saying French toast, because the French don't realize that we give them credit for it. You know, and you want to have a coffee and a juice and whatever else. That's a great place to do it because the vibe is very nice. It's warm. The people are friendly. It's still on the left bank, but it's not as touristy of a location. So it's a little bit off the beaten path, but you're still a stone's throw from the Sorbonne and a couple of other really noteworthy landmarks. And then you can kind of get away and do a little bit of writing.
Okay. Are there a couple general rules that we could follow, like a rule of thumb? Let's say, I'll use an example, and I don't know if this is true, but there are so many different types of French wines, for example. So would you say, okay, well, if you're in this or this neighborhood, you know, just order the house wine because it's going to be, you know, 90% as good as, I'm not saying that's true. I'm just saying, are there any general rules of thumb? Like if you go to order coffee, order this kind of coffee. If you're going to do this, and can you think of any?
Yeah, it's tough because I have become a total specialty coffee drinker. Like I can enjoy like an espresso on a terrace wherever. So I guess that'd be kind of there's an inversion there. So if your audience is into coffee, you can kind of only get one half of the best world when it comes to coffee. So on the like general French bistro, cafe, corner cafe, whatever, if you are anywhere from Starbucks and up, as far as your expectations go, like bring those expectations down. There's not going to be a caramel macchiato, no pumpkin spice. And if you're a specialty drinker, yeah, good luck getting a good cup of filter or like a flat white, whatever you're looking for, ain't going to happen. However, the coffee will be hopefully passable. It's the environment that you're there for, and they will leave you alone. Like you can sit there with your cup of coffee. You can write on your postcard. You can watch the world go by, because people watching is one of the number one things to do when you're in Paris. They literally set up the chairs on the terrace, all facing out, so everybody can do the people watching. That's the way to do it, because it's not going to be that expensive. You can get a cheap espresso. Man, I can't even speak French or English anymore. And in all of that, you'll be well set up and well left alone. On the other side, there are some really great specialty coffee places that you can go and get like a great cup of coffee, a great flat white, whatever it is you're looking for. Without the caramel macchiato, pumpkins, you're going to have to go to Starbucks if you want flavors. But like the downside is that the seating arrangement is going to be a lot shorter. They're smaller. Their margins are tighter. So you're not going to get quite the same, like, I can just sit here and camp out all day kind of vibe. So that's something. As far as wine goes, I would say that like you're going to want to go for your like the Burgundy wines. I think would be generally they are going to be, if you're a red wine drinker especially, they're going to be I would generally, if you see it on a list, that's the one to go for. If they give you that option by the glass, whatever. I think everybody has this knee-jerk reaction to go for Bordeaux, which if that's your thing and you know you love it, that's great. But if you're new, especially to red wine, and especially if you're going to try out some natural wine, which can be kind of funky, then Burgundy is definitely my preference. And all of my far more experienced, knowledgeable, and intelligent, beautiful, handsome wine friends would also push you that way.
Cool, man. Thanks for the tips. Your YouTube channel offers helpful, uncommon advice for Paris travelers. Can you want to share where everybody can find you, just so if they want more Jay, they can go get some?
Yeah. It's going to be just my name, Jay Swanson, J-A-Y. You got to spell it out. I did see one guy just use the letter the other day, and I was like, okay, that's a problem. So J-A-Y Swanson, S-W-A-N-S-O-N. Just Google me. You can find me on YouTube is going to be the best place, but we're putting out a lot more videos on Instagram. And I do have a guide to the city, which we made a little discount code for you guys as well, which is also going to be confusing because it's zero to travel. You spell out zero and it's the number two, and then you spell out travel. Although I don't know how you wouldn't spell out travel. And that'll get you guys 10% off if you want all my recommendations, all my tips. It's like 144 pages worth of information that we put into an online guide now. So
thanks for that.
It's there.
Yeah, but you're messing with my brand, man. We don't have the number two in our brand. No,
I know.
Kidding.
I was
okay.
Like, I was looking at it.
It's okay,
like,
Jay. It's okay.
I didn't choose the discount code. In my defense.
No, that's all good. No, that was very kind of you. So that thanks for extending that to the listening audience. Just like a last question, how do you make a living on YouTube with less than 100,000 subscribers? And just give us your number one piece of advice.
Whoa. How do you distill that down? Okay. I think the main thing, so the way that I did it was because of my wonderful patrons. So, which hopefully some of them are listening right now. I'll definitely be sending as many of them over this way to listen as I can. I basically just made a commitment. I wasn't making a living when I first started. I was daily vlogging for a year, made a video every day and didn't even cross 1,000 subscribers. And then the second year of doing it, I was like, you know, if I'm going to do this, I need to make a commitment to pitch my Patreon at least twice a week. You know, there's something that I've gotten away from and I need to get back to. And just slowly but surely over the course of the time, people did. So I've never made a huge amount of money on YouTube, but that I made enough to get by and then more than enough over time. And so now it's between that and selling my guide, like you just hopefully you offer real value to people, whether that's Paris tips or something emotional. And then, you know, they support you in turn. That's always going to be the hope. So
cool. Can you leave us with a famous Parisian saying or anecdote or quote or something that we can carry with us the rest of the day, let's say?
Sure. How about the motto of the city, which I will not try to say in Latin because I don't think any of us know how, but it basically translates to tossed but never sunk. The symbol of the city is a ship, on the water, because Paris, maybe less famously now, but used to be a major port. And so the symbol of the city has always been a ship for hundreds and hundreds of years. And under it, they wrote tossed but never sunk, because Paris has always been tossed around and beaten by the waves. But as the strength of the people have shown, it will never sink. And that's the hope, that hopefully your audience gets a little bit of that today. And they know that no matter how hard life can be, and no matter how much you get tossed about, surround yourself with good people and you'll never sink.
I love it. Tossed but never sunk. We'll end on that note. Thanks so much, Jay. Great connecting with you.
My absolute pleasure. Thanks for having me, Jason.
Cheers.
There you have it. Thank you to Jay for stopping by the show. One quick reminder before I share a personal story from Paris. If you have not gotten on our newsletter list, you can sign up over at zerototravel.com/newsletter. It is free. You'll see a little sampling on that page of the types of newsletters we send out once a week. I send out. So if you want a little bit of extra travel gold, some musings, some destination ideas, all kinds of stuff, you can sign up over there. It's free. Okay. I was in Paris on my very first backpacking trip way back in the late 90s. That sounds so long ago, maybe because it was. But anyway, staying in a hostel, and I remember being in a room with, you know, there was a couple guys from Sweden, there was somebody from Canada, there was, you know, the typical hostel thing. It was a dorm room. I think we had about, it was 10 or 12 beds. I can't remember where everybody was from. They were from all over the world. And for some reason, the entire dorm room gelled. Like, we all became friends and had such a great time together. And we had this impromptu, who knows what time it was in the middle of the night, sorry to everybody staying there, international soccer match where we where we set up the bunk beds as goals and we were playing the soccer game. And this didn't even take place in the city of Paris, but it was just such a magical travel moment, because I remember looking around and thinking, wow, look at these people from all over the world. We are laughing till we're crying every, I think, 5 or 10 minutes. We're having the time of our lives, and we're just in this crappy dorm room playing this soccer game with some ball we probably found in the corner that was all beat up. And it was the magic of travel right there in that room all together. This whole international crowd, and just having this magical moment, creating memories, laughing till we cried. It was amazing. And when I was recording this episode, for some reason, that was the memory from Paris that popped up. It wasn't seeing the Eiffel Tower and having a picnic under it. It wasn't seeing the sights and everything like that. It was being in that hostel room playing that ridiculous soccer game at 2 in the morning or whatever the case was. And that's travel, right? It's the people we meet. It's those experiences we have, I think, that stand out, the ones that are beyond the sights. The sights are great. The history is phenomenal. But it's often those other moments that we remember. And I haven't been to Paris since. I'd love to get back. So I hope this podcast helped give you some ideas for your first or next trip there. I'm going to close out with a quote from Anthony Bourdain. I feel like we've never quoted Anthony Bourdain on this podcast. I might be wrong because I've done hundreds and hundreds of shows now, but I found a quote from him about Paris and I thought, well, this would be a good way to close it out. So here it goes. Quote, "The vacation gone wrong in Paris is almost always because people try to do too many things. Most of us are lucky to see Paris once in a lifetime. Please make the most of it by doing as little as possible. Walk a little, get lost a bit, eat, catch a breakfast buzz, have a nap, try and have sex if you can, just not with a mime, eat again, lounge around drinking coffee, maybe read a book, drink some wine, eat, repeat. See? It's easy." End quote. So Bourdain, that quote is. Anyway, his point of doing as little as possible, I love the counterintuitive nature of that and how we could take that exact quote or that mentality. You can mix in the things in the middle that you love. It doesn't have to be all the things he mentioned, but mix those in. And when you go to a place that there's so much to see, doing as little as possible might open it up in a whole new crazy way. Who knows? But I thought I'd leave you with that. And wish you a good rest of your day, evening, night. Thanks for listening. And I'll see you next time. Peace and love to you and yours. Cheers.
This podcast has been brought to you by ZeroToTravel.com. Ideas and advice to make your travel dreams a reality.